Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. He's Leighton Kling. I'm Trent Kling. Coming up on today's show, we lead with earnings from Rite Aid, but also a couple of smaller news stories catching our eye this week. Bed Bath & Beyond kicking out One Kings Lane, and a regional grocer and a footwear retailer combine in the upper Midwest. Our interview guest today is Bobby Marhamet. He is the CEO of Radiant. Radiant, a firm that provides a large variety of visual solutions for retail and hospitality outlets throughout the U.S. They released their State of the Consumer Behavior 2020 report, but with all the COVID-19 stuff going on, haven't had a chance to air his interview. So his interview recorded about a month ago, but he's got a lot of great insights, and I highly recommend sticking around for that. A reminder, you can like us, rate us, however you access us, whether that be on Podcast Addict or Podcast Republic or Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Blueberry or Stitcher, the list goes on and on. If there is a podcast app, we are probably on it. Also, you can check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. Also on YouTube, our podcasts, I should mention, are on YouTube as well. So we begin with Rite Aid. They provide a negative surprise this week, at least as far as earnings were concerned. Earnings that showed a far greater loss than expected. Now, expectations coming into the call were for a loss of 13 cents per share, but instead, Rite Aid earnings came in at a loss of 37 cents per share. Now, this would be understandable for a business that was forced to close in the later part of the quarter as a result of the pandemic, but it seemed a bit odd for a company like Rite Aid, especially given that the quarter's end in this case was on February 29th. So before many of the stay-at-home orders started, but after the first wave of panic buying for things like sanitizer and bleach. The call on Thursday, though, resulted in around a 30% dip in the Rite Aid share price. Not all was negative. We'll get to some of the positive a little bit later on, but the question, Leighton, as always, is how did we get here as far as this loss per share is concerned?
Yeah, it certainly is odd. And if we dig into the numbers, we can see this was for their fourth quarter of fiscal 2020. I was just actually at a Rite Aid just before we're recording this, Trent. I was at a Rite Aid in Gardena, California, which is in Los Angeles County, and they had quite a bit of foot traffic because everything else is closed. So the nearby grocer had foot traffic, and then, of course, Rite Aid had foot traffic, and they were filling prescriptions as well. But the odd thing is that many of their numbers actually appeared quite good this last quarter, sales-wise at least. Their same-store 30-day equivalent script count in their pharmacies rose by 5%. Their front-end sales, their more retail-centric sales, excluding tobacco, were up 1.5%. And as far as the reason they are excluding tobacco sales from their metrics, they began restriction of tobacco sales to those 21 and older at around this time last year. So they began this practice in the first quarter. If you want to include tobacco sales in these comps, their comps still went up by around 0.1% year over year in the fourth quarter. We don't give too much credence to sequential comps, but do feel that it is important to note that both comps numbers, with and without tobacco, were their best in over 2 years. Three of their four quarters in fiscal 2020 saw positive comps excluding tobacco. In fact, including tobacco sales, the fourth quarter was their first quarter of rising front-end sales in over 2 years. Overall revenues were also up by around 6.5% year over year, and the company led with the highlight of the fourth quarter adjusted EBITDA number actually increasing by $1.5 million over last year. Additionally, they were very bullish on the free cash flow as a result of a reduction in retail inventory, and you can see this walking through the store firsthand, Trent. They don't have a lot of inventory. Yes, they have one of everything, but not a lot of multiples of those one and done type items. Those items that really aren't consumables, but think of maybe over-the-counter drugs that they don't really need to hold on to a lot of on a quarter-to-quarter basis. They were able to reduce their leverage ratio from about 5.9 times in the third quarter to 5.3 times at the end of the fourth quarter. So saying all of this, where did that net loss come from? Well, they saw a number of financial pitfalls in a few key areas. They paid around $1 million more in interest expense this year over last year. However, the big one is taxes, and this was somewhat unexpected for us to see, at least, as the increase from the fourth quarter of 2019 to the fourth quarter of 2020 was enormous. Rite Aid paid a whopping 80% more in income taxes in 2020's fourth quarter than last year. This led to increased expenses over $150 million. Once this was adjusted for, then you can really see the increase in EBITDA. However, still a decrease in EBITDA as a percentage of overall revenue. And their EBITDA number is still only 2.37% as a percentage of revenue, far from what you would want to see from a retailer in this space. All things considered, Trent, their income before taxes was actually around $8.2 million in the positive this fourth quarter versus the negative $60.6 million it stood at last year. And there was also a LIFO, last in, first out charge, rather, of around $72 million that appeared on adjusted earnings this year, ensuring that their adjusted earnings per share is lower this year than last. All of this is to say, while they saw a net loss due to accounting measures, they still feel pretty comfortable about their overall sales trends within the company.
And, you know, honestly, we are the Retail Focus podcast, not the Accounting Measures podcast. So let's get into those trends that they're seeing. While most retail pharmacies are seeing increases on the pharmacy end, and they've been seeing increases on the pharmacy end for the past several years, with things more or less even and sometimes negative on the front end, Rite Aid saw things almost the other way around in this quarter. In fact, things were relatively even between the two sides. They saw a 160 basis point increase in comps on the pharmacy side of things, which was roughly equivalent to their comp increase when you take out those tobacco sales on the front end. Now, on the pharmacy side of things, they did mention it's driven by an increase in immunizations, that script count also that we discussed being up 5%, but also, and this is a big one, prescription file buys, something we always pay attention to in the retail pharmacy space. To let you know a little bit about prescription file buys, the momentum has kind of slowed from the wild days of 10 years ago or so, where we were seeing buyouts left and right of pharmacies and local chains. Rite Aid, though, did make progress in the 2020 fourth quarter, fiscal 2020 at least. Prescription file buys basically take place when a retail pharmacy buys the script files of another. Usually the trend is for a larger national chain like a Walgreens or a CVS or a Rite Aid, even a Walmart, to purchase the files of smaller local operators who are either closing, some of them are retiring, they're aging out of the business, or they're otherwise going out of business. So those prescription file buys, Rite Aid felt like, helped that script count growth to that 5% number. And by the way, that 5% number, that was also their biggest gain posted in several years, even though pharmacy comps taken as a raw number were kind of middle of the road for them. That 160 basis points, they've seen better, they've seen worse over the last 3 years. Now, this shows the impacts of an increased influx of generics. So they're filling more prescriptions. They're just not seeing the monetary benefit. And we've been discussing that in the retail pharmacy space for some time. But all of this, Leighton, was overshadowed by the big jump in same-store sales, excluding tobacco sales that Leighton, of course, discussed earlier. Now, while it was unexpected to this extent, it does make some sense when you look at the categories that were up for them. Momentum was seen in upper respiratory, pain care, and first aid. Now, keep in mind, this quarter ended February 29th on Leap Day. Upper respiratory was something we actually noted back in February had been a big category for retail pharmacies and others even before COVID-19 took the U.S. by storm. And as an aside, there's some thinking now that a wave of COVID-19 might have gone through the U.S. in January or earlier, if true, might explain some of this momentum that retailers were seeing in upper respiratory and some of the cold and flu medication that was flying off the shelves at that point. But as far as pain relief and first aid are concerned, we talked about the first wave of panic buying, and this is something we actually discussed on the podcast. Talking to people this last week, especially in California, you were seeing that first wave of panic buying starting really mid-February for sanitizers and for pain products. Pain relief and first aid, that makes sense. It was the first wave of panic buying there. Now, private label penetration also helped them. and helped on the margin front probably as well. They needed all the help they could get because of that hefty tax bill that Leighton was talking about. Private label penetration actually increased for them 148 basis points year over year to grow to 20.69% of overall products sold. This is a major focus point for Rite Aid as they go forward. And in fact, one of the things that Rite Aid mentioned after they concluded the sale to Walgreens and said, hey, we're basically starting from scratch, we're moving forward from here, is saying, hey, we've got to get our private label on par with other retail pharmacies, on par with other retailers in general. And we saw definite momentum to that effect in the fourth quarter.
The company did release sales numbers for March, and we saw the dramatic pop that we were expecting. Front-end sales increased 33% year-over-year when excluding tobacco. Hot categories included sanitizers, of course, wipes, paper products, and basically all over-the-counter medications. You see people buying up everything, even though none of it actually kills coronavirus. But you would think that the panic buying would have a negligible impact on script count, but this was actually not the case, as scripts rose 8.3% because of an acceleration in 90-day maintenance prescriptions. Basically, people were attempting to get out in front of their three-month scripts by refilling a little bit early, and that actually does make a lot of logical sense. And in my example here of going to a Rite Aid earlier today, Trent, I think a lot of people were doing that. They're trying to get in and out as fast as possible, and those people that were being proactive are trying to refill the prescriptions a little bit prematurely in order to not see as many people. They're trying to socially distance themselves away from everybody else in that pharmacy line. However, they did say that most benefits from the increase in March sales were offset by pay adjustments, bonuses they gave out, increased cleaning charges for stores, and increased credit card fees. The latter is something we haven't really heard a lot of businesses discuss, but it is important. With more people desiring to go to contactless payment or buy online, pick up in store, companies may see more in not just swipe fees, but the additional fees experienced for card not present transactions. With an increased focus on liquidity lately, since COVID-19 restrictions have put a financial hurt on most retailers, they did note that their current liquidity is at around $1.9 billion. Liquidity has been a question for Rite Aid in the recent past and was a big reason why they've attempted to pull the trigger on a number of deals to sell off stores over the past 5 years before doing so with Walgreens most recently, as we had talked about extensively on this podcast. They did draw around $180 million on the revolving credit facility as a precaution, however, and this is something that we would advise. We're not financial experts, but we would advise a lot of larger retailers to do while they still have the option and while there is still a lot of liquidity in the markets before everything comes to a halt in terms of banks really having some looser guidelines, especially to a company like Rite Aid, which has had, of course, liquidity problems in the recent past. Looking ahead, Trent, Rite Aid is one of the few retailers who actually did not withdraw guidance for this upcoming fiscal year, despite the uncertainty of the COVID-19 related impacts. They last released guidance for the 2021 fiscal year back on March 16th, and they took the step of leaving it unchanged, saying it was too early to tell how they would need to alter guidance, if at all. Their exact words were, the company does not have enough information about the ultimate impact of COVID-19 on fiscal 2021 results to justify changing guidance. That guidance, by the way, provided for a 1.5 to 2.5% gain in comp store sales. They still expect a net loss for the full year of around $91 to $119 million, but they anticipate this being much less than what they have trotted out for the 2020 fiscal year. And still, Trent, if you look at their balance sheet, you look at the cash, their liquidity, that means that they're going to be around for some time. So for everyone saying that they are still headed towards doomsday after all of the stores that Walgreens acquired, I think they could be wrong.
Sales certainly pointing in a stronger direction for Rite Aid. And as you mentioned, they still have a decent balance sheet, not the way of JCPenney or Neiman Marcus, we'll talk about later just yet. By the way, one thing I did want to note just in closing here, their website doesn't reflect it, but their investor relations presentation that accompanied this quarter was the first to reflect that new logo that was rolled out for them last month. Now, Armin Witt, former podcast guest of Under Consideration, noted that it appears to be somewhat of a contradiction. It's got some older values to it, like Mortar and Pestle. It's got some newer, edgier components to it, like a shield on it. Now, one of the things I do like is they're changing the color from red and blue to light green and blue. So almost, if you're familiar with the soccer team Seattle Sounders, kind of looks like Seattle Sounders colors there. But when you look at the logo, one of the things that stood out to me, I like the shield. I like the font. It's kind of an older Art Deco font, but not too old Art Deco. It's still very clean. It's still very sans serif. But there are, just above the mortar and pestle, three leaves, and they're shaped in much the same way as the Albertsons three leaves are in the middle of the A in the Albertsons logo. I found that very, very interesting because, of course, Albertsons had kind of that failed takeover bid, or the takeover bid that was shot down, basically, by vote of shareholders. One thing that they do want to do with this brand, they're looking to roll it out in October. I should say in the fall, not specifically October, but Leighton, you're around a number of Rite Aid stores. We've both been to Rite Aid stores in a number of parts of the country. And Rite Aid does and has really struggled keeping stores up to date, keeping them looking modern. So this is going to be a necessary refresh. But they said one of the most exciting things about the refresh, they want the brand to resonate with those who are caring for, and I quote, multi-generational households, but they put including pets there. So that gives you a little bit of a hint as far as when they do this brand rollout in the fall, they change things up a little bit. Something to perhaps look for, maybe they're looking to jump on the pet bandwagon. And of course, we've seen, at least so far, early numbers indicate sales of pet products have not gone down because pets still need to eat, they still need to interact and play, and COVID-19 has not changed that. So just a couple of things to keep your eye out for, especially that new logo from Rite Aid. Well, coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Bobby Marhamet. Once again, he's the CEO of Radiant. He'll be joining us to discuss their State of Consumer Behavior 2020 report. This in regards to the in-store experience. And, of course, why customers choose brick and mortar or e-commerce, one of the two. No surprise to our listeners that we love data, especially data, of course, pertaining to retail. But we're going to widen our scope a bit this week to the full year. And that's because Radiant recently released their State of Consumer Behavior 2020 report. There's a lot of great data-backed insights in this report, and who better to discuss it than Bobby Marhamet, the CEO of Radiant. Radiant is a firm, by the way, that provides a large variety of visual solutions for retail and hospitality outlets throughout the U.S. Bobby, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Absolutely, Trent. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First, just to kind of frame things for our listeners to begin with, where is the data for this particular report coming from, and why does Radiant take an interest in this type of consumer data?
You know, one of the segments that we really focus on, and customers come to us to try to build experiences in stores and retail. And with that, we wanted to make sure that we provide our customers and our, you know, merchants, if you will, with the relevant data that they need to create these in-store experiences. So our marketing team set out and we surveyed 1,000 U.S. consumers about, you know, their shopping habits, both online and in-store, to really kind of learn the insights and be able to provide them with better information.
Now, as far as some of those headlining results were concerned, there was very much an underscored importance surrounding the in-store experience, and you asked a lot of questions regarding the in-store experience. I was wondering if you could break those numbers down a bit for us.
Sure, absolutely. About 68% of the respondents said a good in-store experience is either important or very important to them. And, you know, that goes a long way in the sense of, you know, shopping habits have changed over the years. And although, you know, there's some misconceptions about where retail is heading, part of the reason that some merchants and some retailers are doing really well, while others are, you know, saying, hey, maybe we had a year where sales were flat, is because the ones that are focusing on the in-store experience are really the ones that are really gaining the loyalty of their customers and building a brand that their customers can relate to. So, you know, 68% of respondents said a good in-store experience is either important or very important to them. People who prefer to shop at physical locations really name the ability to see and touch products as the primary differentiator. But close therein is an enjoyable shopping experience and being able to be relatable to that actual customer. So about 40% said, you know, primary differentiator is to see and touch products. About 38.5% said an enjoyable shopping experience is key to them. And the other, you know, interesting part here is if we break down, you know, males and females and how their shopping habits are a little bit different. For men, the shopping experience trumps the ability to be able to see and touch products. And for women, it's more, you know, prioritizing the physical presence of products. And a secondary element is really, you know, preferring the experience. But lastly, what I'll say is price remains king, but really experiences provide differentiation. Experiences give the ability for brands to be able to relate and create a loyal, you know, following. And that's a lot of the insights that we share in there. And as you said, it's detailed in the sense of how we try to take a look at the shopping experience and give good data back to our readers.
And I wanted to get into that just a little bit more because I know it's easy to be kind of agnostic as far as that particular data. But when we talk about in-store relatability, obviously touching and feeling the products, that's inherent with the physical space. But what are some ways in which retailers could or perhaps should do a better job in terms of conveying that relatability in a brick and mortar sense?
It depends. You know, I think first and foremost is understanding their customers. And, you know, that's, we help a lot of brands figure that out. Like, who are the customers that are coming to your store? What's the demographic breakdown? Once you understand that, a bunch of things you can do. We have retailers all the way from, you know, playing different types of music at different times of day based on the clientele that's walking into their locations. You have some retailers playing, you know, videos about other products that maybe their customers didn't know, again, at different intervals. You have kind of larger brands playing, you know, something consistent across all stores and then playing something more localized at different times of day on, you know, screens that they have in store. You have other retailers, you know, giving education of products and how a product is sustainable or how it's produced, because consumers care about that these days. And then, you know, all across the board, it's really like, how do you put this together? Like all the way from once I understand my customer, what types of music do I play? What sort of promos do I push? What sort of education do I provide in the store location? Putting that all together is what we help retailers do.
Now, another interesting thing that you found, and we're going to skip a little bit from brick and mortar to e-commerce, is that convenience was a primary motivator for those that prefer to shop online. But there were some other findings, and of course that makes sense, but there were some other findings that you had that caught us by surprise a little, like, for example, discount codes being a big reason people turn to e-commerce, and transaction speed, which is interesting because that's something that a lot of e-commerce retailers have tried to cut down on over the last few years. What did you find interesting about consumer motivations as far as e-commerce or being pushed to e-commerce in certain circumstances from the survey?
Yeah, I think one of the notable things here is if a brand hasn't created, you know, really kind of a loyal following, even within a subsegment of their customers, you know, price and again, promo codes and being able to get something done fast and transact quickly and get the best deal is one of the main reasons that people go online. Based on kind of our learning here, if there's discount codes being pushed and a product is really in a place where people understand it and it's really, you know, I want to say, you know, a high level commoditized, then buying online, having a discount code to push that sale and that speed of sale is important. If it's something where you're building a true kind of brand experience for customers and your products are differentiated and your experience is differentiated, you know, what we found is people want to still come back into the store and see and feel and touch and experience everything there is to experience in store.
One of the other interesting findings that I wanted to touch on with you here is the study found that of respondents 18 to 34, 55% prefer to shop online, yet we know from data from the retail businesses themselves that the actual revenue from that age group is still skewed towards brick and mortar. Why, as you look at it, might there be a bit of a gap there, even though the preference is to shop online, but those dollars are still coming in through brick and mortar?
Yeah, I think because, so when you're shopping online, again, based on kind of our learnings here, when you're shopping online, if I want a white t-shirt, I'm going to go buy a white t-shirt. That may be the only purchase I make. But if I go into the store location because I'm looking for, let's say, for example, that same white t-shirt or jacket or whatever the case is, if that retailer is actually creating that experience in store where I learn about new products or I see new products or I feel and touch new products and being able to group those correctly, being able to give me the education in store, being able to even give me a an extra promo because I came in the store. If I bought the white t-shirts, I can also get something else for, you know, X percent off. That's the reason that, you know, the dollars are kind of higher in store. Whereas when you're buying and shopping online, again, from our learning here, you're really just going for that one or two things that you already know, and you're using that promo code to get the best deal, and speed is important to you, so you're trying to get out.
Regarding the study and the survey results, was there a particular finding that maybe you weren't expecting or maybe caught you a little bit off guard?
I think the one thing that caught us off guard is how we knew high level, you know, some of the shopping has kind of shifted online, of course. But I think based on digging into demographic and age groups here, the learning of how things transform and the dollars that are actually exchanged with, you know, kind of a dominance on how much is purchased in brick and mortar stores versus online was definitely a learning on our side. And I think the other big learning was based on, you know, what people are buying, they could be, you know, shifting their habits to online versus e-commerce.
Now, I wanted to ask you this because not only are we talking about the state of consumer behavior, but you're also a retail industry veteran. You've been around the retail landscape for a while. Where do you feel like consumer behavior as a whole is headed over the next 2 to 3 years?
I think using technology to create better experiences is not about the technology because, you know, people think that, oh, if I just, you know, put together these 3 or 4 technologies, I'll be able to, you know, increase my sales and my average dollar amount per sale and all that good stuff. But it's really about how you take that technology to build a better brand experience for your customers, how to relate better to them, and how to get them to actually see your brand as a differentiated brand. So I think one of the things that we'll see over the next couple of years that will actually come out and be one of the focal points of how retail is changing again for the next, you know, few years is tying in artificial intelligence into the shopping experience. And I know artificial experience these days is a buzzword, but really taking that a step farther and personalization is really what matters. And being able to use artificial intelligence to personalize, to be able to make that shopping experience in store just as, you know, low friction as it is online, but also give you the amount of education that you need and create that experience. I think that's what's going to change in retail over the next few years.
And again, we've heard it time and time again before, but it bears repeating. It's not always about the technology. It's how that technology gets implemented there. Finally, I wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions, or really one quick question about Radiant. I know another round of funding was just closed out there. What's on deck for Radiant as a company, and where can our listeners see Radiant's product offerings on display?
What's on deck for Radiant Next is we've had so much attention to our product because, again, we're helping customers actually come to us and actually dissect their journey, their customer journey, and then use the technology to be able to relate better to their customers. So as a company, we're growing really rapidly. We've had lots of interest to actually get another round of funding closed even before we're actually even looking for it. So that's what we look forward to here in the next kind of few months. And, you know, here's a fun one, we just signed, you know, Mark Wahlberg, who's, of course, many people know who he is, and he's very involved in the retail and restaurant industries, and specifically on the retail side, and, you know, subsegment of really, you know, supplements from GNC or like training from F45. Like, he's helping really kind of pave the path of creating experiences in retail, and we're excited to kind of work with him to see how he can, you know, educate more and more retailers and restaurant groups and how they can expand their in-store experiences to be able to relate better to their customers.
Fantastic stuff. Once again, Bobby Marhamat, thank you so much for joining us, the CEO of Radiant. Thanks for taking the time today on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you, Trent. Appreciate it.
Well, once again, we thank Bobby for joining us. Again, that interview recorded a little over a month ago, but because of the pandemic, haven't had a chance to get it out there. We had some pandemic-related interviews that kind of hopped in terms of the line, so we appreciate Bobby for joining us here on the podcast and hope you found that informative. Now, a couple of smaller stories crept across our radar this week, and we wanted to cover both of them in the second segment of the podcast. We begin with Bed Bath & Beyond finally disposing of One Kings Lane, and Leighton, the initial purchase of One Kings Lane took place in 2014, and at the time, the company didn't disclose the purchase price. However, they said on an earnings call afterwards that it was non-material, but this is a move that we've been fairly bearish on for some time.
Yeah, that's right. And Bed Bath & Beyond has a lot of different angles to be viewed from in a negative light. They've been seeing changes in upper management over the past year or so, and they've really been sort of in this downward spiral with massive stores and just lack of merchandising creativity. But going back to 2015, we were fairly bearish on the move, this particular move, failing to see how an e-commerce proposition that was rapidly taking on water would help Bed Bath & Beyond, considering the lack of strength in the brand overall. Not a lot of people were aware of it. Bed Bath & Beyond at that time felt the acquisition could open themselves up to potentially, again, a new customer base, a different set of customers. They weren't that well-versed in the online space, and they thought that maybe this would help diversify their customer base. And whether this happened or not, the benefit over the last 5 years was far outweighed by the financial negatives for the company. And we would see that quarter after quarter. Given these earnings releases, you would see a lot of things, a lot of vague notes, but would ultimately point to a not very well-performing asset within the company, within One Kings Lane. And the acquisition was part of a larger trend of brick-and-mortar retailers acquiring e-commerce companies through the mid-2010s. So one could say they were just trying to keep on trend in order to really keep up with the online customer. But we saw the same from everyone from Nordstrom to Walmart, as companies couldn't acquire e-commerce retailers with mounds of debt soon enough. In some cases, you could actually make the argument that it worked out. Walmart scored Mark Lohr, for example, from Jet.com. But in most cases, we've seen the e-commerce acquisitions over the past few years either be sold off or closed entirely. And I think this really speaks to the idea that companies like Walmart that have a lot of cash on hand, they can make big bets on small companies that don't have a lot of brand equity behind them, and they can fail, and that it can be okay because they have cash at the end of the day and they have continuing operations that are giving them that bottom line needed to go off and continue to make different acquisitions. But a company like Bed Bath & Beyond, where one could argue for some time has not been operationally efficient, one should be scratching their head at those kinds of moves. It was really the case of throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall and hoping something stuck. One Kings Lane simply did not stick. And if you look at the divestiture, reported by the Wall Street Journal, took place for an unnamed price to an unnamed buyer. We will at least find out the price at some point during Bed Bath & Beyond's next earnings call, or be able to dig through the numbers and kind of get an idea of exactly how much that asset was worth. But the sale was revealed publicly on a conference call held by Bed Bath & Beyond CEO Mark Trenton. And this appears to be a larger effort of Trenton to really focus the company towards their core competencies, again, if they have some at this point, which is something he's touched on several times since first taking over. The sale of subsidiary personalizationmall.com is also said to be in the works as well. As the CEO noted, 1-800-Flowers is in line to acquire the company. As before, he did not note the prospective sale price, but did say that they are attempting to hustle and get a deal along and going. But this is also understandable. First, you don't want to hold an unsuccessful company or a company that doesn't fit with your organizational goals any longer than you have to. And we could argue that they've held on to these companies way too long as it is. Second, Bed Bath & Beyond would no doubt like any cash they could capture from such a deal, since the vast majority of their locations have been closed due to the pandemic, and they've really not been known to have the strongest e-commerce traffic as of late.
So we move from Bed Bath & Beyond to an interesting partnership we teased in the introduction, but Hy-Vee and Designer Brands announced a partnership this week that will see the grocer in Hy-Vee, a regional grocer in the upper Midwest with about 245 locations, sell DSW shoes through their website with potential add-ons as the deal goes forward. Now, this is something that we did not at all see coming, especially with Hy-Vee's gradual movement away from the massive footprints that they had been rolling out and the clothing in store. They had a brief veer in that direction around 4 years ago in 2017. Last couple of years, we've seen media, especially out of Des Moines, which is where Hy-Vee is based, stating that Hy-Vee might start to go away from that direction. Now, they did partner with Canadian retailer Joe Fresh to put clothing and shoes in select stores last year, so the idea of apparel in Hy-Vee wasn't completely dead. But recently, Hy-Vee has been using some of that square footage that had been ticketed towards apparel to offer increased grocery selections rather than build out their clothing selection a la their rival Kroger and Kroger's marketplace iterations in their many brands throughout the country. Now, this interesting partnership has a number of facets to it. The first, the partnership will really be unable to get up and running full tilt, at least right away, in part because of COVID-19 related impacts. When you think about the resets and the infrastructure needed to accomplish everything that the partnership aims to do at maturity, that's going to likely get in the way of grocery employees just fighting to keep everything stocked right now. And meanwhile, most of DSW stores have been closed since March 17th, although their e-commerce fulfillment remains operational. So we've seen kind of a halting of business as usual for both companies. But in any case, the first step of the partnership will be a DSW, what they call a digital experience on Hy-Vee's website. This, when you look at who it's going to benefit, it could provide a slight benefit to DSW because of Hy-Vee's digital traffic increasing since COVID-19 restrictions. You don't think people are going to be going to Hy-Vee's website specifically to seek out DSW products because, as we mentioned, DSW is a fully functioning and just fine e-commerce site on their own. They've actually been one of the more successful shoe-related retailers over the last several years. But this is more of a placeholder until other partnership measures are able to be implemented. That said, there was a link in the press release that was issued by these companies jointly to this digital experience. As of right now, it just redirects to the Hy-Vee main page, so it isn't live quite yet. But some of the other capacities that they want to build into this partnership once it really and truly gets going includes buy online, pickup in store capabilities for DSW customers, as in customers may potentially purchase DSW products online and pick them up at select Hy-Vee stores. Again, you're looking at what I perceive as a slight benefit to DSW. They've noted a significant amount of digital product being buy online, pickup in store in previous earnings calls, and Hy-Vee stores occur in greater concentrations when you look at the number of locations and the number of markets in the upper Midwest and the size of markets as well. You're looking at a store that occurs just more frequently than DSW stores, but also in a different setting. You look at a DSW store that's occurring in more of a shopping center and more of a complex. Hy-Vee stores are more that neighborhood grocery store, again, with those neighborhood hard corner real estate operations. So you're looking at a little bit greater convenience for the person that is seeking to buy online and pick up in store. The question remains, it wasn't really addressed in this press release or in any of the other further articles about it. How will this infrastructure work? How will DSW get this product quickly enough to Hy-Vee stores? And that's the key, is the speed. Can it work quickly enough to ensure that customers can pick up their products within the short turnarounds that are now expected in the industry? Gone are the days where you're fine with buying online and picking up in store 5 to 7 days later, JCPenney. Now it's got to be a 1 to 2 day turnaround to really provide that benefit to the customer. Otherwise, they're just going to have it shipped to their house. Now, the infrastructure is one thing, but as far as Hy-Vee is concerned, this may provide a very slight benefit, but you look and Hy-Vee has massive brand awareness in their market, so this is more of a convenience for the DSW customers who are likely going to Hy-Vee to pick up groceries anyhow. Now, that being said, Hy-Vee is no doubt getting a kickback from the products that they sell. But late in the final step in the partnership, which again might be delayed because of COVID-19, is the actual physical merchandising of DSW product in Hy-Vee stores.
It is unclear, based on the release, exactly how many Hy-Vee stores they are aiming to carry DSW product in once the program is mature. But you look, it was noted that COVID-19 impacts will keep the program from hitting the ground running. In the interim, they are seeking to have pallet sales of DSW merchandise in Hy-Vee stores where possible. This may serve as a slight benefit in allowing Hy-Vee and DSW to evaluate stores where a full merchandise outfit might be well played. And I think this is interesting, Trent, because While it's not the best merchandising strategy, it is still going to give them insight nonetheless. The pallet sales will begin at more than 120 stores, and for reference, this is right around half of Hy-Vee's overall store footprint. They have 245 stores in total right now. Assuming this rollout happens quickly, it may be a win-win for both retailers, as the number of retailers in which customers can buy shoes has in fact dwindled, and in areas such as Michigan and Vermont, is basically zero because of in-store limitations right now throughout the country. You see a lot of similar things happening. And honestly, Trent, shoe retail, it's not the sexiest type of retail, but anytime you have a large footprint, you're trying to maximize sales per square foot. And I think this is one way to do that, certainly with these kind of synergies or partnerships, what have you. Retail Dive did note that partnerships such as these may be a little bit more common if COVID-19 related closures continue for much longer. It's likely that Hy-Vee and DSW were in talks about this partnership before DSW stores closed, based on the language in the press release. However, it would not be unthinkable to see certain brands or stores scramble to attempt to build out these partnerships if it becomes clear that everything will be closed for another several months. And this is kind of genius if you think about it, Trent, because there are a lot of unknowns with COVID-19. A lot of municipalities have shut things down. For instance, me riding by on my way to Rite Aid today, I saw several parks say closed until further notice. Well, when is further notice? What does that mean? Do we have any specific numbers that we can go to see when things will be lifted for these particular retailers? And the fact is, a lot of senior executives, a lot of CEOs of small retail firms have said they've been given no guidelines from governors or more local municipalities such as mayors or city council members. So that is certainly going to be something popping up. If they can get sales of their current goods sold, especially those retailers that are maybe in an industry where they need to get rid of inventory because they have maybe some debt to pay off in the short term, that would be very essential for them. This may also prove out another cautionary tale for non-essential retailers. Maybe striking partnerships with essential retailers will be the best way to hedge bets when this potentially happens again. So a way of thinking about the future is going to be a little bit different for these retailers. If everything shuts down, let's say this time next year, so 12 months from now, how are we going to be able to weather that storm if we just get through this one?
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where we each talk about a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. I'll go ahead and go first. It was announced this past week that the Small Business Administration has actually run out of money for the loans for the Paycheck Protection Program. Now, this is interesting because we noted on the show a few weeks ago that the program was designed to go through lender banks. There were a lot of people complaining that banks didn't have their stuff together. They couldn't find a bank to actually perform the application through. And by the time the applications were actually due and all the money doled out, a lot of businesses were left standing. So the reason I'm looking ahead, is there anything that's going to be done? An early indication is that there will be, but what will be done to help out the businesses that didn't get to this program in time? We're talking about a $349 billion government program. And I think, I'm not sure if I'm going to say everyone underestimated the issues caused by COVID-19 closures, but I will say this, a lot of governments now are moving towards, you know, Layton was talking about when are we going to restart, when are things going back to normal. We heard Kansas just today come out and say that just because of COVID-19, they were expecting now a $1.2 billion deficit, which for a state the size of Kansas is enormous now, when they were going and planning on running a surplus because of loss of sales tax money. We heard from Colorado today as well. They're looking at a partial reopening of the economy in May. A lot of these states are starting to figure out that the sales tax revenue isn't coming in like it was. The thing is, sales tax, that's not really a federal government issue. And so these states right now are going to be hurting if something isn't done to keep these small businesses afloat. and be able to keep these small businesses open, or at least the staffing to the small businesses open. And I'm not suggesting that there's a correlation between the money coming in through the Paycheck Protection Program and sales tax revenue coming in, but certainly it does help if you're a business to keep your staff on, to be able to be open, even if limited hours, because you're being partially subsidized by these forgivable loans. So what's the SBA going to do next? What's the federal government going to do next? And again, it all comes down to this. What's the future investment going to be like as far as entrepreneurial small retail, especially when it comes to brick and mortar, but also to e-commerce? Again, if you're an entrepreneur sitting on the sidelines right now, you're looking at this and saying, well, unless I want to start an essential retailer, I might not ever want to start a retailer again because of the ability to just shutter all stores by government, but not really do anything to pick up the slack for these businesses, or to create a program like the Paycheck Protection Program that appears to not be as effective in terms of getting money to everyone that was wanting to apply. So a lot going on here, but I'm going to be looking at this not only for the next week or month as far as what's going to be done short term to just keep these businesses alive and keep them from going bankrupt, but long term as far as, does this dissuade entrepreneurial money from coming into retail, coming into other sectors where, again, if you're not essential, you can just be closed at a moment's notice.
Well, Trent, you alluded to it before, but my looking ahead has to do with a potential dead retailer. And this is never something we like to talk about on the podcast, but it's kind of our duty to talk about this. And also, we talk about dying malls a lot of times, and anchor tenants are usually the first to go in malls. And Neiman Marcus is an anchor tenant in several malls throughout the United States. Not Class C malls, not Class B minus malls, but mostly Class B plus and Class A malls throughout the country. Neiman Marcus, for those of you who don't know, they've been around since 1907. That's roughly 113 years ago, Trent. They've been around for several generations, and they were kind of the first of their time, a luxury department store that catered to women's fashion, and they've done a really good job over the nearly 113 years they've been around in really catering to their customer base. And they've grown in different areas over the years. They now have an online presence, of course. And overall, if you look at the business, it's had multiple different owners. It's had different management over the years, but they have had one thing constant in the last several years, and that is high debt levels. And so if you look now at their owners, they're currently owned by Toronto-based Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board, and then Los Angeles-based Ares Management, who has several other retailers in their portfolio as well. If you look at the high level of debts they have right now, Trent, you can see that this was going to become an issue, especially during COVID-19. They have no revenue coming in, obviously, and so they began talking about furloughing their employees. They have around 14,000 employees was the number that we found. We found varying numbers, a little over 14,000 in some cases. They have headquarters employees in Dallas, Texas, and then also those store employees that are going to be affected at their 42 locations. They also have a variety of non-Neiman Marcus locations, so 24 Last Call stores, and it's 2 Bergdorf Goodman stores in New York. So you're looking at that debt, Trent. It's unsustainable right now. And if you look at some of the quotes out there from different firms that rate companies, they're saying that optionality, or the ability for Neiman Marcus to turn around at this point in time, is growing increasingly high. So they have a high inability to turn their current operations around. And it's really a matter of what's going to happen as far as a liquidation or maybe a sell-off. A lot of retail analysts, and I found this very interesting, are saying that they could just sell bottom dollar, and they're confident that they could actually keep much of their operation going. And so I find that to be interesting, and that would definitely help not only those nearly 14,000 employees I mentioned, but also if you think about the landlords that hold Neiman Marcus stores, that would be beneficial for them, and then just beneficial for everybody as well, the customers that they've been servicing over these last dozens of years. And so I think this is going to be interesting to see if they do just sell out, and if the creditors are okay with maybe taking a significant decrease from the amounts that they are owed currently, and just saying, okay, continue as best you can, new owner, with this Neiman Marcus concept, or if they liquidate entirely. But overall, it would be a question of when bankruptcy court is going to happen, when is COVID-19 going to not be a thing and people are going to actually be able to shop at these stores, because right now none of these stores are open. So they, again, have no revenue coming in, and so they certainly can't liquidate at this time. So a lot to unpack here, but curious to see how this plays out.
That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. And next week, we've got another COVID-19 themed interview, but it's lightly COVID-19 themed, because we're going to talk with Nicole Amsler about businesses that are gaining market share during COVID-19 and what they can do to maintain that market share after things return to some semblance of normal. Really excited about that interview. We're editing it up as we speak. So once again, for Leighton, I'm Trent. Thank you for listening, and so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.